G'day, welcome to The Local Update, a podcast looking at local issues taking place around the Bega Valley, issues and events, of course, as well. Over the weeks, you will hear interviews with artists, musicians, politicians, and spokespeople for different events and organisations present around the Bega Valley at this particular point in time. We'll also catch up from time to time with the likes of Bega Valley Shire Council, perhaps the Bega District News, and other organisations around town that might have information they need to share with you. My name's Indy Wood. I'm your host on a weekly basis. And we'll also catch up with regular guests, one of whom is Graham Farram. Now, Graham is a member of the Bega Pioneers Museum. He likes to read a bit of poetry here and there, read excerpts from non-fiction books that tell us a little bit about events from the past in the Bega Valley. And each week I'll catch up with him to find out what new little tidbit he's found. This week, Graham kicks things off right back where he was last week with his friend and yours, Mr. Henry Lawson.
The poem that I'd like to kick off with today comes from favourite poems of Henry Lawson. The particular poem that I'm going to speak is The Glass on the Bar. This book was published by Charles & Associates, first edition, 1968. It's in the Bega Valley Shire Library, 821.2 Laws. Three bushmen one morning rode up to an inn, and one of them called for the drinks with a grin. They'd only returned from a trip to the north, and eager to greet them, the landlord came forth. He absently poured out a glass of Three Star and set down that drink with the rest on the bar. "There, that is for Harry," he said, "and it's queer. 'Tis the very same glass that he drank from last year. His name's on the glass. You can read it like print. He scratched it himself with an old piece of flint. I remember his drink. It was always Three Star." And the landlord looked out through the door of the bar. He looked at the horses and counted but three. "You were always together. Where's Harry?" cried he. Oh, sadly, they looked at the glass as they said, "You may put it away, for our old mate is dead." But one, gazing out o'er the ridges far, said, "We owe him a shout. Leave the glass on the bar." They thought of the faraway grave on the plain. They thought of the comrade who came not again. They lifted their glasses, and sadly they said, "We drink to the name of the mate who is dead." And the sunlight streamed in, and a light like a star seemed to glow in the depth of the glass on the bar. And still in that shanty a tumbler is seen. It stands by the clock, ever polished and clean. And often the strangers will read as they pass the name of a bushman engraved on the glass. And though on the shelf but a dozen there are, that glass never stands with the rest on the bar. Of course, the Bega Pioneers Museum is, its collection is housed in the old family hotel, which dates back to about 1857. We're sitting in the New Park, brilliant facade, Federation style, and there's clerestory windows that light up. It all got a big write-up in the newspaper when it opened in 1900. But it made me think that poem about people who ride out and don't come back. One person who didn't ride out, of course, was Edward Ridley, who's buried out at Tanger in a single grave out there, the only one at Tanger that we know of has a grave surround, just near the old church there. One person who rode out and didn't come home was Dr. George Imlay. And last week after the recording, I took Peter Lacey of Recollections and our staunch member, Peter Brickwood, out to the Tarraganda Cemetery and to the private cemetery at Corrigeri. And next week I'll say a bit more about that. But first, we drove up to a small monument that's not very far along the Dr. George Mountain Road from Bega, where there is a small cairn that records that this is the spot where Dr. Imlay was found after riding out from Corrigeri, and taking his own life. I had thought that the Dr. Evershed Memorial Clock was the only memorial to a single person down here. I'd heard that a long time ago. But that one on Dr. George Mountain, certainly for a single person. We went to the Tarraganda Cemetery and then we went on to Corridgery. We had to watch out for snakes. If you ever find your way out there, do beware of the snakes. The peppercorn trees seems to be a favourite haunt for them. But when I was looking at monumental inscriptions in the Bega Valley Shire, Book 4, I came across another private grave on the Snowy Mountains Highway, it says, 1.4 kilometres from its junction with the Princess Highway, north of Bega, on the Camellia property at Stony Creek, is the grave of one of the pioneers of the area. The grave has been completely enclosed with concrete, once surrounded by a post and netting fence long since fallen down. The headstone is of sandstone with a marble plaque attached and was transcribed in February 1988 and reads as follows. In loving memory of Archibald Spence, died 18th of January 1915, aged 72. Archibald Spence was the original owner of the property and was the grandfather of the 1988 owners. There's a map reference if you want to look that up, and a not to scale drawing. I can recognise where that is. But there's a little bit more information in a book called They Made This Valley Home, Story of the Pioneer Women Who Helped Build the Bega Valley, as told by Sandra Florence and Di Pryor, both members of the Bega Valley Historical Society. And this book is available in the museum for about $15, I think. There's a small mention on page 87, Mrs. Janet Spence. Now, she was the father. Janet's second and youngest son, Archibald Alexander, 1843 to 1914, bought property near Bega and became a successful farmer. He married Mary Elizabeth Kerrigan, and some of his 13 children's descendants are still on the land at Stony Creek near Bega, which I thought was rather fine. But who owns that property now, I'm not exactly sure, but we could definitely find that out. It got me thinking, though, we have a volunteer in the museum, Pauline Pendergast. Her people were instrumental in settling Jindabyne, and you can find out a bit more about them if you actually go up to Jindabyne, just have a walk around. There are nice plaques in the shopping centres which tell you a little bit of the history. But she's been assisted to go and get our mail on a Wednesday by a fellow named Peter. And he came to us from Nevertire, and that's a name to conjure with. There's no doubt at all about that. But he said, there's a poem by Henry Lawson. I visited my father not so long ago. He's in his 80s, and I said, what do you know about Nevertire, Dad? We'd been talking about all the little places that got mentioned in the bushfire crisis that we've been having. Little towns all over the place, locations that you either know or you don't know. But he knew Nevertire. He'd been out there. It's out beyond Dubbo. And he knew the poem, Jack Dunn of Nevertire, and that was great because that gave me a way to just really find it. This is a lonely grave story as well. Jack Dunn of Nevertire. It chanced upon the very day we'd got the shearing done, a buggy brought a stranger to the west a Sunday run. He had a round and jolly face, and sleek he was and stout. He drove right up between the huts and called the super out. We chaps were smoking after tea and heard the swelling choir, for one has travelled by the name of Dunn of Nevertire. Jack Dunn of Nevertire. Old Dunn of Nevertire. There wasn't one of us that knew Jack Dunn of Nevertire. Jack Dunn of Nevertire, he said. I was a mate of his, and now it's 20 years since I set eyes upon his phiz. There is no whiter man than Jack, no straighter south the line. There is no hand in all the land I'd sooner grip in mine. To help a mate in trouble, Jack would go through fire and flood. Great Scott, And don't you know the name of Dun of Nevertire? Big Dun of Nevertire, Long Jack from Nevertire. He stuck to me through thick and thin, Jack Dun of Nevertire. I did a wild and foolish thing while Jack and I were mates, and I disgraced my governor's name and wished to try the States. My lamps were turned to Yankee land, for I'd some people there. And I was right when someone sent the money for my fare. I thought 'twas Dad, until I took the trouble to inquire and found the man who sent the stuff was Dun of Nevertire, Jack Dun of Nevertire, Soft Dun of Nevertire. He'd won some money on a race, Jack Dun of Nevertire. Now I've returned by Liverpool, a swell of Yankee brand. I reckon, guess and calculate to wake my native land. There is no better land, I swear, in all the wide world round. I smelt the bush a month before we touched King George's Sound. And now I've come to settle down. The top of my desire is just to meet a mate of mine called Dun of Nevertire. Was raised at Nevertire, the town of Nevertire. He humped his bluey by the name of Dun of Nevertire. I've heard he's poor, and if he is, a proud old fool is he. But, spite of that, I'll find a way to fix the old gum tree. I've bought a station in the north, the best that could be had. I want a man to pick the stock. I want a super bad. I want no bully brute to boss, no crawling, sneaking liar. My station's super name shall be Jack Dun of Nevertire. Straight Dun of Nevertire, proud Jack from Nevertire. I guess he's known up Queensland way, Jack Dun of Nevertire. The super said, while to his face a strange expression came, I think I've seen the man you want. I think I know the name. He had a jolly kind of face, a free and careless way. Grey eyes that seemed to smile, and hair just turning grey. Clean shaved, except a light moustache. Long limbed and tough as wire. That's him, that's Dun, the stranger roared. Jack Dun of Nevertire, John Dun of Nevertire, Jack D from Nevertire. They said I'd find him here, that cuss, Jack Dun of Nevertire. I know his walk, the stranger cried. Though sobered, I'd allow. I doubt it much, the boss replied. He don't walk that way now. Perhaps he don't, the stranger said, if years were hard on Jack. But if he were a mile away, I swear I'd know his back. I doubt it much, the super said, and sadly puffed his briar. I guess he wears a pair of wings, Jack Dun of Nevertire. Jack Dun of Nevertire, brave Dun of Nevertire. He caught a fever, nursing me, Jack Dun of Nevertire. We took the stranger round to where a gum tree stood alone, and in the grass beside the trunk he saw a granite stone. The names of Dun and Nevertire were plainly written there. I'm all broke up, the stranger said in sorrow and despair. I guess he has a wider run, that man that I require. He's got a river frontage now, Jack Dun of Nevertire. Straight Dun of Nevertire, White Jack from Nevertire. I guess St. Peter knew the name of Dun of Nevertire. Well, I thought that that was rather fine, and I'm sure that we all know that feeling of walking down the street or being somewhere unexpected and you go, I know that person, even though they're a long way away. You know, there are places around the world that are famous for, you'll meet everybody if you stand on this corner. The thing that struck me just at the moment as we've suffered from fire, flood, was the idea that poor Jack, he caught a fever, nursing me, Jack Dun of Nevertire. We've all got to watch out for that now. COVID-19.
Graham Farram is the former proprietor of Mumford's Books here in Bega. He's also been heavily involved in the regional gallery, and these days you'll find him on a regular basis, a few days a week, in the Bega Pioneers Museum. In last week's episode, I shared with you a feature that I put together about the koala surveys being conducted in the southeast forests of New South Wales. Making up the majority of that feature was Chris Allen, a senior threatened species officer with the Office of Environment and Heritage. Chris still does a bit of work with the Office of Environment and Heritage, but it's not his only role these days. I caught up with him recently because I thought we might want to find out exactly how the koala population around this region is going, post-drought, post-fires, and just generally, 6 years on from that feature that I produced in 2014.
I'm Chris Allen, and I'm currently the spokesperson for the Koala Action Network, which is focused on a range of activities trying to conserve the koala population in the southeast New South Wales coastal forests between Tarta and Wallaga Lake.
Where do we stand at the moment, Chris? The last time you and I spoke was about 2013, 2014, and at that point you were suggesting to me that while the numbers were frighteningly low of koalas, you had seen perhaps almost up to a 50% increase in the population of koalas in those southeast forests at that point since the 2007 start of the surveys. Where are we now?
Andy, looking back at that time now, with the benefit of hindsight, I'd have less confidence that I could put a number on that kind of increase, 50% or whatever. I mean, I think looking back on it now, looking at our results, thinking about, you know, the potential error rate in the work we do, I'd say that all the information was telling us that koala numbers had increased, but to what extent, I'm not confident. I can't really tell. We can't really tell from the information we've got. All we can say was that there was an increase in the number of grid sites that we went to where we found koala pellets, evidence of koalas. Now, since then, we've gone back. You know, we've got something like over 900 sites through the study area where at each site we've done the same search. We've searched for koala pellets under 30 trees. And we've just done that over and over again. And all credit to the local community for the contribution they've made to those surveys. So we have now, you know, we've just sort of stepped beyond a bit now, and we've had biologists from Canberra Uni who've been working with us, looking at the data, and they've come up with a subset of grid sites for us to go back and monitor each year. So it's a smaller number of sites that have been revisited, and we have revisited those sites over the whole study area now, and what I can say from that is that there are, this is the results up until last year, there doesn't appear to be any significant change up or down in occupancy rates. For this population. It doesn't seem to have been much of a change. Now, since then, we've had the drought really bite hard, and then we've had the fires.
And those fires that hit Mumbler Mountain must have had some sort of impact on the populations in the Tangier State Forest.
It's been a miracle, really, how much of the core koala habitat through these forests did not burn. And all credit to local brigades and National Parks and Wildlife Service brigades, and then the subsequent really huge support that was put into holding the fire where it was held. So effectively, it was held on the western edge of most of the habitat sustaining that population. Some of it burnt, for sure, but it was a relatively small amount. And indeed, much of that which burnt, and this was the luck of the weather, really, much of that which did burn, it was not an incredibly severe fire that went through. Much of the canopy was intact. So in terms of the immediate impact of fire on the population, I suspect that it probably wasn't big, but we don't know what the impact of the drought has been. That may have been quite serious. We don't know what the impact of the smoke has been. We don't know what the impact, you know, the animals must have gone through weeks of a high level of stress, so what that impact has had. So there's a lot we don't know about what's happened at this stage.
We're obviously not meant to encourage groups to get together at the moment, are we, given this COVID-19 thing that's going on? But I'm interested, are there planned surveys coming up? Are there events down the track that perhaps locals might be able to get involved in to continue to help?
2 weeks ago, I would have said volunteers will be a very important part of that program, as indeed will be representatives from the local land council. As we speak, we're asking the question, how are we going to manage this with COVID-19? And it may be we'll have to put it off until we can be confident that people aren't being put at risk in doing this sort of work. I mean, you know, the amazing thing with COVID-19 is the best place to be is out by yourself in the bush.
Yes, really. Yes.
Yeah. And is there a way we could do this so that people can have that experience of being out there and just taking in the beauty of the place at the moment? And my goodness, where it is, like, you know, we've been through a hell of a year, haven't we? But the bush at the moment, the country out here is just looking so good, and it's so rejuvenating to be out there. So I'd really like to think we could carry on with the program. It'll be pretty different from how we might have thought it was a few weeks ago, but we'll just have to watch this space.
I guess the other thing I should ask you then is, we've talked about this possibility that there may have been an impact on koalas due to smoke, etc., after those fires. If we were to find a koala that had been affected in the bush in these current times, what should we do?
Marking a tree, just saying, oh, yeah, you know, if there's a koala up a tree, just mark the tree where the koala is. Now, if people carry a bit of tape or plastic tape or something around, and then, you know, so a clear route back to the road, the nearest road, mark the tree on the road, you know, have a sense of any information about how far. But certainly, yes, if you can get a grid reference, fantastic. And then we'll follow it up from there.
Is there somewhere that people should go online or an email address that someone people should have if they want to express interest in getting involved in these surveys when they might happen in the future?
Look, we're just about to put together a Koala Action Network website. As soon as that's up, that's the place to go.
All right. I'll get those details off you in the future, and I'll add them to whatever article I write as a part of this, mate. So that's absolutely fine.
Very good.
Well, it sounds like perhaps it was a positive outcome, hopefully. Hey, so best of luck. Chris Allen, thank you so much for your time.
You're most welcome, mate. Okay, then.
Okay, bye-bye.
All the best to you. Bye-bye.
Chris Allen is the spokesperson for the Koala Action Network, a group of concerned citizens and community groups looking out for the livelihoods of the koala communities in the southeast forests of New South Wales between Permugui and Tathra. You are listening to The Local Update, a community podcast looking at issues and events taking place around the Bega Valley on a regular basis. My name is Indy Wood. Thank you so much for your company this week. Thanks also, of course, to Graham Farram for his latest edition of his poetic prose, and also Chris Allen, spokesperson for the Koala Action Network, based here in the Bega Valley. Nice to catch up with him again. Now, next week, in addition to another catch-up with Graham Farram, I'll be chatting to Kathleen McCann, local permaculture gardener, who's going to let us in on a few tricks on how you might survive in your own garden, feeding yourself in these dangerous times. If you're looking for more info on any of my guests or some more information about this Local Update podcast, indiemedia.com.au is the website. You'll find all kinds of blurbs, updates, and any info that I think is going to help with any of these stories will be added to articles on that website, indiemedia.com.au. Thanks again for your company, and until next week, bye now.